From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Democratic candidates for president are about to cause fundraising gridlock in Hollywood as they come calling for show business dollars. Then actor and musician Steven Van Zandt talks about how his music has changed since his last solo album from 20 years ago.
My five records of the 80s were extremely autobiographical and extremely political. And I wanted to get away from both things. You know, enough of me already. I've analyzed me to death. And I've also, politics is no longer relevant because now it's in your face 24/7.
All that coming up on The Frame. The presidential election is a year and a half away, but Democrats already are working the campaign trail. With 21 Democratic challengers in the race, the candidates are making the fundraising rounds, and that always includes Hollywood. While money from the entertainment industry isn't the top source of political dollars, the publicity that comes with celebrity endorsements, combined with the town's tight-knit fundraising circles, has turned Hollywood into an essential stop. I checked in with Ted Johnson on how Hollywood is influencing the 2020 campaign. He's a senior editor at Variety who covers politics, and he began by explaining why he thinks Hollywood donors flock to political events.
I think it's almost a status thing to say, hey, I mingled with this presidential candidate. Back in 2008, when Barack Obama ran, so many people jumped on board very early on. And through the years, I can't tell you how many donors I've talked to who kind of boasted about the fact I was with Barack Obama from the start. I was with him maybe even at his Senate campaign. So there's certain cachet involved. Others actually are looking for ambassadorships. Joseph Biden is having a big event next week in Hollywood, and there's a number of ambassadors who are on the list. If you raise a lot of money, you tend to get attention from the presidential candidate, and that's some of the fruits of the labor.
So when Barack Obama was running for president in 2008, and he had been visiting Hollywood before, basically it was Barack and Hillary Clinton at the time, and the town was a little bit divided over who to support back then. Now you have almost, what, are we almost up to 24 candidates now? Does it feel like some donors are waiting and maybe not sure who they're going to get behind now, not writing as big a check as they might be able to?
Someone like Joseph Biden has longtime ties, so I think a lot of people are naturally signing on to his first fundraiser because they know him, and they certainly think that he may be one who can beat Trump. But what I've also noticed is you look down the list of some of the co-hosts, and they're also contributing to other candidates. Peter Chernin, he signed on as a co-host of the Biden event, but he's also signed on as a co-host of a Kamala Harris event that's going to take place on June 3rd. And you're seeing a lot of that this time around.
Peter Chernin, I should add, is a former very senior Fox executive who is now a producer. There are probably a lot of issues that are important to people in Hollywood. I want to ask you about one in particular, and that is income tax. Bob Iger has made a lot of news for how much he's paid and a Disney heiress complaining that his compensation is insane. So how does that play out when a lot of people in Hollywood make a ton of money and there's a lot of talk in the Democratic Party right now about taxing those people a lot harder than they have been taxed?
Back in 2017, the motion picture industry was one of the bigger boosters of this corporate tax cut. That was their leading agenda item, and it went through when we saw tax reform pass as President Trump's signature achievement. What you're seeing now are a lot of studio executives signing on to some of these Democratic campaigns, and the candidates are promising to roll back that corporate tax cut. Now, where it gets a little dicey is where it gets personal. You've had Bernie Sanders actually vocally criticized Bob Iger, who is a longtime Democrat, and Iger may speak out on it and say, wait a minute here, don't attack me. We're both kind of on the same page when it comes to a desire to get Trump out of office.
We're talking with Ted Johnson. He's a senior editor at Variety, where he covers politics. I think you and I both know Hollywood has a mixed to very poor record when it comes to representation in front of and behind the camera. But when it comes to political candidates, it does feel like the town is very excited about the potential for the first woman, the first Latino, first gay president. Is that kind of identity politics important to Hollywood to be part of something that is history making, like Barack Obama's the first African-American president?
We saw this kind of immediate turn to Pete Buttigieg the minute that he came on the scene. He's kind of a new rising star. And you saw a number of gay and lesbian donors, very high profile, kind of race to host events for Pete Buttigieg. So he's going to be in town next week. He's doing four different events, but then he's back in June, and he's going to do an event over at the home of producer Ryan Murphy, a very successful producer. And it's kind of a who's who of gay Hollywood who have signed on as fundraisers. I think a lot of those people probably were thinking, I'll support someone like perhaps Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, until Pete Buttigieg came along and really kind of made a name for himself.
California is obviously one of the bluest states in the nation, but does that mean any Republicans come? Does Donald Trump visit town to try to raise money, or is it not even worth the airfare?
Actually, Donald Trump was in town several weeks back. He was raising money, but it tends not to be from the entertainment industry. I know talking to some of the Republicans who are within the business who are Trump supporters, they're kind of reluctant to sign on to some of these fundraisers because it puts you into the Federal Election Commission roles. And there's kind of some reluctance because there's a lot of pushback right now.
I'm going to ask you one last question. Get out your crystal ball, give it a polish, make sure it's operational. Kamala Harris right now leads in terms of money raised in Hollywood. 2 months from now, 3 months from now, will it be her or somebody else?
I would say that it's going to be between Harris, Biden, and close behind Pete Buttigieg. You just look at the number of events that Hollywood figures are sponsoring for these candidates, and it's not really that difficult to kind of gauge, you know, where the money is going to come from.
Ted Johnson is a senior editor at Variety, where he covers politics. Ted, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, actor and musician Steven Van Zandt has a new album dedicated to the deeply polarizing issue of summertime. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today is Thursday, and that's when we send out The Frame's weekly newsletter. It's a great way to stay current with our show, and you'll also get headlines from the world of culture. You could sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. And now, Steven Van Zandt, Little Steven, Miami Steve, the guitarist of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, wears many hats, but usually it's a bandana. As an actor, he played Silvio Dante on HBO's The Sopranos and Frankie the Fixer on the Netflix series Lilyhammer. But Van Zandt is also an activist, radio host, producer, and songwriter. The music you're hearing is from his new album. It's titled Summer of Sorcery. It's Van Zandt's first record of new music in 20 years. He recently returned from touring his previous album of cover songs titled Soul Fire. When he came by the studio yesterday, Van Zandt talked about getting his band, the Disciples of Soul, back together and writing new music.
Yeah, it's a big deal, especially the part of writing for yourself, as opposed to, during that time, I did do the entire score for Lilyhammer, you know, while I was doing that show, which was 3 seasons in 4 years. But it's different.
Was it a two-part deal? It's like, you know, I'm going to act, but I also get to do the music?
Well, I was actually, it was a once-in-a-lifetime gig, because I co-produced it, I co-wrote it, I directed the final episode, I started
the package deal.
And I did all the music, yeah.
You know, so they running the snack table, they got doing the whole thing.
I cooked dinner for everybody, you know. but writing a score, you know, and the music supervision as well, is different than writing for yourself. So when you're in that cycle that we all live in, the album tour cycle, right? We all kind of grew up with once we're in the business. Your radar is always up, And you're always making notes, you know, little things that occur to you during the day. It might be a phrase, it might be an idea, it might be a piece of melody. And you're, you know, recording little bits and pieces. And then, you know, when you go to make a record, no matter what it is, you have just hundreds and hundreds of bits and pieces that you can draw from, you know?
So that time period actually gives you a repository of information to...
It would have. It would have. If your radar remains up. I closed it down. So when I came to Soulfire and realized I was going to come back into the business, you know, so to speak, after 20 years, I knew I couldn't write something, so I decided to do covers of songs I'd written for other people. And at that moment, I said to myself, okay, I really shouldn't do a Soulfire Part 2. You know, I really should come back.
If
I'm going to come back in, I really should, you know, take up from where I left off, more or less. So at that point, the radar went up, you know, back up. And the tour was essential. You know, we've been on the road for now 2 years, really, with Soulfire, and just concluded the Soulfire tour in Australia 3 days ago. And that was a big, big step, because I managed to keep the same band. And these guys are all the best session players in New York, so it's been a miracle to keep them. But they've been extremely loyal. And so about 6 or 8 months into the tour, slowly ideas started to come back, you know. Slowly started to get bits and pieces. And by the end of the tour, I was writing. And I probably wrote the whole thing in about 3-4 months.
Wow. And there are songs that people would say are autobiographical, and there are songs that people would say are for me. And there's a distinction with a difference. How would you say those two things are different? Because a lot of these songs feel as if they are for you, even if they're not about you.
Well, that's the key to this record. When I realized very dramatically that I write very differently for other people than I do for myself. You know, my 5 records of the 80s were extremely autobiographical and extremely political, you know, and I wanted to get away from both things. You know, I decided, you know, I like the way I write for other people, you know, and I'm sick of me. I've gone through me. I've enough of me already. I've analyzed me to death. And I've also, politics is no longer relevant because it's in your face 24/7. My usefulness right now, I think, is to, you know, give people a break from the politics, which is the opposite of what I used to do. So with that in mind, you know, I set out to make a record that was not political and not autobiographical, make like, you know, 10, 12 little movies that I could be a different character in each one.
And fictionalize. What you're describing is acting as much as it is singing. That you are creating dialogue for a character,
yes,
who looks like you but isn't you, and that's what you're going to do on the record as well.
Yes, looks better than me, hopefully. But yes. and actually, every singer is actually an actor anyway, even though you may not be conscious of it. But that song is a script, and you are convincing an audience that it's real. You know, our particular art form lends itself to at least feeling like the most autobiographical art form, you know, whether it is or not. You know what I mean? Because you are delivering the song personally. You know, people assume it's true. You know, what you're saying is true. So it was just a more exaggerated version of that in terms of the actual separation of myself from the characters. And I wanted to do that, and I did it. I'm very happy with it.
We're talking with musician and actor Stephen Van Zandt about his new album called Summer of Sorcery. I'm going to play a song from your new album. It's called Love Again. Northern lights blew my mind ever is with ease. Got a picture of Brian Wilson that I pray to every night. Please let this be the first summer of the rest of my life. So a couple of things. There's a reference to Brian Wilson in this song, which I think is not random. What about that reference that is important to you?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you know, Brian Wilson invented summer. He's actually born like the day before or the day after summer begins, you know. And it's just a fun reference to him. This is a guy, the character in this little movie has had an unrequited love affair or whatever, and you know, he's traveling around the world trying to just escape from the clutches of the addiction of love, and realizes he can't get away, so ready to give it another shot. And part of the concept of this album is that romantic fantasy of summer, you know, the wonderful sort of, you know, imagined bliss of you know, possibilities, and that's something that I think represented by the Beach Boys. You know, they really did manage to capture that fantasy of summer really well. So they're referenced a couple times through the album. Yeah.
I'm going to play another clip. It's a concert clip of your talking before a song. I am not going to tell you what year it's from.
We got something going on in America that's they're calling new patriotism, you know? But it don't look like no new patriotism to me. It looks like blind nationalism, you know? And that ain't right. That ain't what patriotism's all about.
You want to make a guess of when that's from? I got the answer.
I know. I think I know.
1984.
Yeah.
And obviously what you're saying then sounds like it could have been said this morning, you know, last night. But
it's a shame, isn't it? You would hope we would have evolved by now.
But it feels like you have a different idea of what your music can do, you know, what you do personally, what you do politically, and what your music does. And Summer of Sorcery seems to represent a different idea. It's more about community and hope and happiness and positivity as opposed to this ain't right. They're not protest songs, in other words.
Right. And that's exactly the intention, which is, you know, I look at my, you know, you look at your work and your life as, you know, how can I be the most useful, you know? And back then, in 84, that's how I felt I could be most useful, by pointing out problems that were not being discussed every day. You know, they were not on the news. There wasn't a 24-hour news cycle. There wasn't, you know, the constant news in your face. And you would go months without thinking about the government back then. And that's hard to imagine now. I mean, months, you know, before, without hearing Ronald Reagan's name even, you know. you know, so now I feel, you know, the usefulness now is trying to find some common ground, because we are literally on the verge of civil war here, and it's really, really, really ugly and getting worse by the day. And I just feel like, let's use music as our common ground, which it is the true universal language, and let's, you know, let's put aside our partisanship, you know. And I've been doing this for the entire Soulfire show, and I will continue to do it for the Summer Sorcery show live. I actually say, like, you know, leave your partisanship outside tonight. We're going to do 2 hours of just music with this amazing band. And I'm going to transport you to a place that, you know, that I call, you know, spiritual nourishment, which I think we need right now in order to go back and face this war that's raging outside and getting worse. So I think that's the usefulness right. Now is to be nonpartisan and to be, you know, as non-political as I can be. I mean, there's some politics right. Built into the songs, of course, but as far as what I say, you know, during the show, it's all very, very nonpartisan.
Coming up, Stephen Van Zandt talks about his New Jersey roots and putting arts education back into schools. Now let's return to my conversation with actor, musician, and activist Stephen Van Zandt. As a member of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band and producer of Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, Van Zandt helped popularize the New Jersey sound, a blend of rock and blues, often backed by a big horn section. On his new record, Summer of Sorcery, Van Zandt doesn't stray far from those roots. We pick up our conversation with a title track from his new album and why it's important to him to celebrate something as simple as the start of summer.
That was, you know, the initial concept, and I wasn't sure I could tap into that. You know, I said, I wonder if I can actually go back and capture that kind of innocence and that kind of wonder and you know, that wonderful feeling of you know, unlimited possibilities. And as I started to write, I realized it was just below the surface. I mean, I got to it immediately because as I analyzed it, I realized, you know what? That romantic fantasy that we all have, we never quite get there, you know? We never quite get there. So it's always in us, you know, just below the surface, you know, sort of waiting to happen, you know? And that's where the whole, once I had that song, I knew I had an album.
You work a lot as a producer. You work with Bruce Springsteen, Southside Johnny. When you are producing other people's work and then producing your own work, is there a different standard? Are you holding yourself as accountable as other people that you might be working with?
Well, as I've often said, you really shouldn't. You should not produce yourself. Through the years, I've gotten better at it. Because what happens when an artist produces themselves is the artist tends to take over, and that's a mistake. So a lot of my early records are a bit extreme in one way or the other, because of the artistic sensibility rather than the practical sort of view a producer would have. All five of my solo albums of the 80s are completely different musically, you know, which is career suicide, of course, you know.
You're not dead yet.
No, but what happens if you're you know, around long enough, you tend to get better. And I finally was able to separate the producer from the artist on Soulfire and this record. And now I will stay with that sound, with that band. I mean, it's the first two records in a row I've ever done with the same band. You know, never mind the same sound, never mind the same genre. You know, it's a soul meets rock thing I went back to because I think that's most uniquely me. And I thought, wow, this stuff it has value. It has a, you know, a unique value. So I'm gonna stay with it. I'm going to go back to that particular sound that we created with Southside Johnny, Asbury Jukes, that I carried into my very first solo album and then abandoned. So I went back to that for the Soulfire and Summer of Sorcery, and I will stick with it now, you know.
You not only have your new album coming out, you also are part of a documentary called Asbury Park, Riot, Redemption, Rock and Roll, and it's about the music scene in Asbury Park. And I wonder, when you think back at the kinds of racial and economic divides that were plaguing Asbury Park in the early 1970s, what got that community back on its feet? What role did music play in that?
Geez, you know, it was right in the middle of the riots at that point. There was a lot of riots around the country, and we had one also there. And so we kind of revitalized the town temporarily, only on weekends, though. You know, I mean, people would come down to the Stone Pony, which, you know, this residency we had with Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. But during the week, it was just a wasteland completely. You know, it was just an abandoned town, really. It just laid there for decades. It wasn't until recently that the town actually started to come back. These last, I don't know, maybe 10 years, maybe. But all through the 80s and 90s, you know, you could have bought the whole town for $1.50. You know, I mean, it was just like a complete waste.
With tax included.
Yeah, because once the boardwalk, you know, once the rides went away, that was it.
I want to ask about another thing you're involved in recently, and that is education and teachers. You marched with the teachers in the LAUSD when they were on strike, and you have a new initiative called Teach Rock. What's the idea behind it, and why is education so important to you right now?
Well, the initiative, teachrock.org, was a way of keeping the arts in the DNA of the education system. The No Child Left Behind legislation of 10, 12 years ago now devastated all of the arts classes in public schools. And so we're trying to figure out a way to keep the arts in there somehow. So we decided.
Because they're like the first thing that's cut whenever there's a budget crisis.
That's right, which is just embarrassing as well as tragic. So we decided, let's do music history. This way we can do it cross-curricular. You know, it can be music class, English class, history class, social studies. We basically just provide a lot of tools for teachers to use, from licensed music to licensed video to... we have 150 lesson plans online right now, and we do more every week. I started visiting some classrooms, and I realized that they're teaching the same way they taught me, you know, which was, you know,
a couple of years ago.
Not a good idea for this generation. I mean, this thing of learn this now and someday you'll use it, well, that's not going to work for these kids. I mean, you know, so we designed something that instead of dragging them to us, we go to them. You know, we say, who's your favorite artist? And they, and there's no wrong answer, you know, and then we just trace them back.
As we go out, I want to listen to one more song from the album. It's called Communion, and I think it really kind of sums up the entire theme of the album. Anything you want to say about this song before we go out?
It sums it up in the three words of the chorus.
Which are?
Unity, harmony, and communion. That's it.
That is it. Stephen Van Zandt's new album is called Summer of Sorcery. Stephen, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Jack. Good to see you.
Steve Van Zandt's new album is out on May 3rd. He's performing May 4th at the Saban Theater in Beverly Hills. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.